is Steve Goodrich, known on the trail as Bird Shooter, and this is N2 Backpacking, a podcast for both hikers and backpackers. Welcome to episode number one, the inaugural podcast at N2 Backpacking. This is Bird Shooter, and I'll be your host here today, hopefully for many podcasts in the future. The topic today, the John Muir Trail. I'm actually going to bring in two of my longtime hiking companions on the show to talk about their John Muir experience in 2006. For those of you that don't know, the John Muir Trail is about 211 miles. It starts at Happy Isles in Yosemite Valley, the northern terminus, and finishes at the summit of Mount Whitney, which is the southern terminus, and also the highest point in the lower 48 at 14,505 feet. So we'll be talking today to Glenn and Susan Schuffenhauer. They go by the trail names Helmet and Doe Girl. And I thought we'd cover some interesting topics like how they plan for the trip, logistics of the trip, maybe some high and low moments that they could share with us, and some recommendations. And this is all from their through hike in 2006. So without any further ado, here are Helmet and Doe Girl. All right, we've got Glenn and Susan Schuffenhauer on the phone. They, as I said, had hiked the John Muir Trail in 2006. Welcome, guys.
Thank you, Steve.
So, Susan, Glenn, I was hoping that you could tell us a little bit about your experiences on the trail back in 2006. But before we get into that, I know you've done a lot of hiking. I know you've done some miles on the Long Trail, Appalachian Trail. I think you've spent some time in Glacier and Denali, and I understand you're headed to Utah this summer. So tell us a little bit about your backpacking experiences, how you got into the sport, and how you got your trail names.
Okay, well, it really probably started back around when we got married. I think both of us had liked to hike and maybe had done some car camping, but the backpacking thing was something that we both wanted to get into, and when we got married, we just sort of kind of started picking up some gear and, you know, did some very short hikes and eventually kind of stretched those out to where we'd go out for, you know, longer hikes and a couple, you know, nights or two, and gradually we ended up planning a couple really big vacations, one of which was the John Muir Trail, but, you know, it was just sort of a gradual process, and I know we've been hiking many times with you, and, you know, that's, you'd offered much encouragement along the way, so that really helped get us get into it as well.
So let's talk trail names here for a minute, because I have personally witnessed the Doe Girl make up a mean dessert of the same name. So, Susan, you care to elaborate on that experience at all and how you got your trail name?
Well, sure. Well, it all started many years ago when I was in Girl Scouts, and when we would go camping, I'm not sure who came up with this. It was one of the Girl Scout leaders in Virginia Beach, and they would make this thing called a doughboy. So you have a wooden dowel and canned biscuits, and you would put the biscuit over the end of the dowel and then cook it over the fire, and then you put vanilla pudding inside and chocolate frosting on the outside. It's a very, very tasty dessert, and so I brought that into my adult life, and we had it on the trail a couple times, and it was such a big hit that it became my trail name.
Into my adult life as well. I've woofed down numerous doughboys in my days on the trails with you, for sure.
Not appropriate to name her a doughboy, though, so a little modification to the trail name.
Yeah, actually a good move by all accounts. So, and Glenn, you got to give us the helmet story. I think I was with you when it went down. In fact, I'll put on the website the picture that you know, properly designates you as the helmet. But please give us the story.
Well, that's true. I think it was on a Mount Mitchell hike, actually, I believe. It was kind of cold and windy, and broke out my fleece hat, which was an REI return good sale purchase, actually. So it's my first time wearing it, and had not received a trail name yet. So put on my hat, which kind of actually resembles one of those old college football helmets, you know, the leather kind from the 1930s. So
very attractive, I might add. Yeah. Always a lady pleaser on the trail, and that Mount Mitchell trip certainly one for the books. A good memory in my mind.
Definitely. So now, whenever it's cold weather, it's where's the helmet? Got to break it out. So
it is stylish. I'll give it to you all day long there on that, Glenn. So I know Susan, aka Dough Girl, is the big planner between the two of you. She's the one that gets the logistics kind of figured out. Well, let's shift gears here a little bit. Talk about the John Muir. It's a trail I've wanted to do for a long time, and I know you guys at least kicked it around for a couple years, I think, before you did it. Susan, talk through just sort of how you, originally got the data together, figured out your schedule, the mail drops, the preparation, that whole process.
Well, of course, I can't remember the name of the book, but I got a book that was about the trail and kind of used that as a basis. And then, a lot of internet research. I spent a lot of time reading people's journals on trailjournals.com just to get a good sense of what kind of mileage most people would get and their impressions of the trail and try to get a sense of to try to find journals of people who sounded like us, to kind of try to figure out what our mileage would be. And that's really where I started. And then I just made lots of lists and spreadsheets and stuff and had a good time figuring it out from there.
So help me understand the mail drops, because I know, unlike maybe the long trail or the AT where you can jump off pretty easy and resupply, it's not really that way with the John Muir Trail. That you have a couple destinations that are very remote. They've got to take food in by horseback. Can you kind of talk us through how that works in terms of resupply?
There are some options, I think, where you can have somebody bring them in, by horseback kind of later on in the trail, but we're too cheap to do that, so I was trying to figure out the most economical way for us to resupply, and so we ended up, we resupplied at Vermilion Valley Ranch, or Resort, whatever
the
it's called, DVR.
I've been there. Lovely place.
We didn't resupply there. I'm lying. Sorry. Where did we resupply?
Muir Trail Ranch?
Muir Trail Ranch. That was our last resupply. That was the big one, because that had to last us, I think it's about the last 100 miles of the trail. So that was a big one. And then I think that was pretty much...
There was one at a lake, I believe.
The lake. Did we resupply at Red Meadow? I can't remember now. My mind's gone completely blank. The big one was Muir Trail Ranch, because you can do it at VVR, but then you get to Muir Trail Ranch like a day and a half later, and so I wanted us to resupply at the last possible point so that, a day and a half's worth of food is pretty heavy. So, and then in the Sierra, you also have the extra challenge of having to fit all your food into a bear canister. So we each had a bear canister, but it's hard to fit, about a week's worth of food in a bear canister. So that was one of the big challenges.
Yeah, and I definitely want to get back to that, because I know you had some issues with bears. But before we jump into all that, tell me this. Now, I know you can go northbound or southbound. I think most people, can correct me if I'm wrong, most people go southbound. Is that right?
Yes, because you start in Yosemite and then you end up on Whitney, and so you're gaining elevation pretty much the whole way. And I definitely wanted to do that because I wanted us to have some time to acclimate to the altitude instead of starting way up high. And plus, apparently, the hike up Whitney from Whitney Portal is brutal, so we didn't want to do that.
Well, and just to chime in on that, after the hiking to Whitney, after being on the trail for all those days, and then hiking back down and out, I couldn't imagine starting out the hike day one and two going to Whitney. I mean, that is just uphill for I don't know how long, and altitude sickness would come into play big time there if you did that. And we saw people get sick or just have issues. So I think the way we did it, to end your journey there is the way to do it.
Yeah, and to remind the studio audience, so Mount Whitney, 14,505 feet, so pretty high elevation. Is it the I believe it is the highest point in the lowest 48, correct?
Yes. Yeah.
I thought so.
Yeah, that's a dramatic ending, too, to your hike, although then you have to hike all the way down to the bottom. But, you know, it's kind of more dramatic to end on Whitney, I thought.
So help us understand the shuttling situation, because, you know, you're doing over 200 miles. You're obviously a long way from where you start. How did you work the... you know, the shuttle from start to finish and getting in there and getting out of there? Can I talk everybody through that?
Yeah, it's actually not as hard as it is for a lot of national parks, because we flew into San Francisco, and then you can basically take Amtrak. They have a series of buses and trains. You can take Amtrak straight into Yosemite. And then from there, you know, you do your hike, and once you end down in Whitney Portal, you basically just have to get a ride from there down to Lone Pine, and then there are a series of buses that you can catch that run up kind of, I guess they're east of the Sierras. You run back up there, and then you can catch another bus back into Yosemite, and then you can get Amtrak from there. So as far as, you know, because we've gone to other national parks where there's really no public transportation available at all, so for this hike, that works pretty well.
And Susan, did you want to point out, too, just a point of clarification? I mean, we did not start actually our hike in the valley, Yosemite Valley. We actually caught another bus due to some time constraints on our trip and vacation. We caught a bus, and I guess we cut off 1 or 2 days going up to Tuolumne Meadows, where we actually started the hike. So just a little asterisk there that... We in the valley, we did catch that bus, which saved us a little bit of time, so we made it so that we could do this hike in the amount of time, you know, that we had available to us.
Yeah, man, I'm taking away your John Muir certificate. That disappointing.
We'll go back and do that part. We'll knock that little segment off next time.
Yeah, we've got that on the list.
Yeah, I'm just kidding you guys, but seriously, the typical through hike, you know, what is the average range of days? Like, if you did a really fast hike, how many days? If you did a longer hike, how long? And the season that most people go, I believe, is August, September, but I'll let you guys speak to that.
Yeah, we went in August, and the weather was perfect for us. We were so fortunate. There wasn't a single raindrop the whole time we were out there. And from what I had read in my research, you know, you don't want to go too early in the season, because then some of the passes are going to be really difficult to get over, because they'll have, you know, snow cover. I mean, there was snow on a lot of the passes we went over in August, so I imagine in June it's pretty pretty bad up there, and plus the rivers are flowing pretty high at that time. So going in August, from everything I read, that's kind of where you have your ideal conditions. And like I said, the weather was perfect for us.
Could you pull it off in October, or are you flirting with disaster with the snow?
I think you can do it, but yeah, I guess you do run the risk of getting caught in some snow.
I mean, and one thing that, you know, really comes to mind when we're talking about the weather, you know, given the elevation there, is how the mornings when you woke up, how cold it was. So you know, were a little leery to get out of your tent, but you got up and were hiking, and then, you know, when the sun came out, how hot we were, probably in the 90s or something, I would say, during much of our hike, and, you know, there were no trees around, really, for the most part. Just, you know, a big fluctuation from morning to, you know, midday as far as what the temperature is on the trail at that time of year.
So I'm guessing you guys are spending most of your time above 10,000 feet, or do you find yourself dropping down into the valleys where you get, you know, 7,000-8,000 feet of elevation from time to time? How does the elevation work on the John Muir Trail?
Well, it goes up as you head south, and I don't know the exact numbers, but pretty much, yeah, I think pretty much every day you're going over a pass that is probably, you know, 10,000 feet at least. Most of them are higher. But I think once you start to get south, I don't think you get very low elevation-wise.
Yeah, I was just looking at the Wikipedia here. So apparently the John Muir seldom dips below 8,000 feet. So that's interesting. I mean, you are spending the majority of your time up pretty high. So no surprise that you got such a big shift in temperatures from day to evening. And how many days did it take you guys to do the trail? And what do you think is, you know, fast and slow out there?
I think it was days? 11 or 12 days, I think.
Yeah, something like that. And how many miles did we end up doing? Like 200, 220?
I think it was about 200 once you count the last bit from the summit of Whitney down to Whitney Portal, which is not officially part of the trail, but you have to take it since you're, otherwise you're just sitting on top of Whitney. And I mean, I didn't feel like we were going super fast and we weren't going super slow.
Yeah, I mean, we had long days. I think we had full days. We were up in the morning hiking early, and hiking probably up till 5 o'clock most days. So we had full days, I think.
So what's that give you in terms of mileage? Are you talking like a 18-25 mile day or?
No,
I think it averaged about 15.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say, about 15 a day.
That's more my style. So, I know it. The John Muir basically runs parallel with the PCT, the Pacific Crest Trail, for I'm not sure exactly how far, but can you kind of comment on that, how the two are parallel and then where they break?
I think they join, like in the south, I think they join just past Whitney, like at Crabtree Meadows or something, I think, and then I think that they're the same trail pretty much up to Yosemite, and then of course the PCT keeps going.
Yeah, I knew that they were pretty close, and the miles they track there. So let's talk about gear a little bit, because I know you guys probably tried to get your pack weight down, and from hiking with you, I know you guys are traditionally pretty smart in what you pack, unlike the camel, who will, we're going to interview the camel, by the way, about the Chattooga River Trail here, I think, in the coming weeks, but anyway, the camel is a mule. Now, you guys are a little bit more, I think, intelligent in what you pack. So, talk about how you loaded your pack, what kind of weights you guys had, that sort of thing.
Well, we definitely tried to keep it, as low as we could while still being, fairly comfortable. One of the big investments that we had for the trip was we got a tarp tent, and that shaved quite a bit of weight off of our packs, and got one that you set up using your hiking poles, which I was taking anyway, so I love things that do double duty, so that was one of the big things we got. It's not cheap, but I think it was definitely worth it for this trip. I think I got a new pack just because any excuse to get, new gear is always nice. So I got myself a new pack, a slightly lighter pack than I had. And I think those were the big purchases.
Yeah, weight-wise, I'm trying to think. I mean, I was probably at 35 pounds, maybe more. I mean, because when you add the bear canister in there, that adds a little weight to, especially after a resupply. I'm thinking back to, that was at the ranch where we resupplied, and, our packs were very, very heavy. I mean, you were happy to eat a meal just because you were hungry, and it lightened the load a good bit. So, but normally we're not, the camel, a hiking buddy of ours, he's a different type there. We try to keep it light, even on short trips, we pretty much lightweight on the gear.
Well, I understand you had a little help on the trail, too, from an animal of the wild. Do you guys want to talk a little bit about your black bear experience? I know that they're pretty strict on bear canisters, and maybe it would be helpful for the audience here to get your story on that.
Well, yeah, it was our first day on the trail, really, and actually it was very windy that day, we were getting into camp late, I don't know, it was probably 6 or 7 o'clock, I guess, but we found a spot, we set up camp, and you're supposed to keep your bear, of course you don't store any food or anything in your tent, so you put your bear canister kind of out, just out in the open, and most people have the normal bear bear canisters. We went with we had a normal bear canister and also a bear bag, which is just a little bit of a different take there. But you know, it's something a little bit more lightweight. So it was very windy that night as we were sleeping, and I don't think we really noticed anything or heard anything other than the wind and our. Bear, our food was really right outside our tent, and then we woke up in the morning, and then Susan said, "Well, where's the bag? The bear bag?" And it was gone. So, and we're talking literally right outside our tent door. So, after some investigation, we found, I don't know, 50 yards away, maybe. All our food just kind of strewn out. The bear went right by our tent, picked it up, walked away 50 yards away, and he had a nice meal. So that kind of let us you know, diminish our supply of food there for the hike. Fortunately, the next day, I mean, we were able to resupply a little. It was okay, but we, you know, kind of lost some of good food that we were looking forward to eating. Susan's, one of her keepsakes from that is a little, I don't want to say jar, plastic squeeze bottle of olive oil, which we still have, which has a still usable and has a bear tooth mark, a bite mark in it. So, but it was just kind of a little bit scary to think we were asleep and the bear walked, you know, right next to us and grabbed our food.
Hey,
yeah, the bag that we were using was legal at the time in Yosemite, but we actually found out the next day from some other people that were camping near us that they had talked to a ranger or somebody else who had said that there was a bad bear in that area who had been stealing stuff from campers just in the last week. So apparently we fed her by accident, yeah. Which you're not supposed to do. But
and yeah. there are different types of, obviously, bear canisters, and they don't seem to bother the normal black canisters that people just sit out, I think, for the most part. But some of them, I think they probably identify and can, you know, like you say, if there's a smarter, troublesome bear or what have you, they'll leave what they know they can't get into, they'll leave those alone and go for the others.
Yeah, I use those bear cans in Denali, and my God, they're heavy, but they're pretty much, you know, indestructible. So I know what you're talking about. It sounds like you had two types, and the tougher type didn't give you any issues. But,
exactly.
You know, definitely interesting, and yeah, I guess the bear did you a favor, lightened your load there a little bit.
Yeah, although we were fortunate in that we got into Red's Meadow probably like a 2 days later, I think. So we were able to buy some more supplies there, and there's a ranger station there where you can rent a bear canister, so we were able to rent another bear canister for the rest of the trip. So otherwise, we would have been in huge trouble.
Yeah, okay, interesting. So I'll shift gears on you guys a little bit. It's an interesting question for you. So, yeah, having thru-hiked the Appalachian Trail and, you know, spent time with the number of couples that were out there, when you're hiking and you're with a partner, and in this case you guys are married, so I got to ask you guys, 24 hours together, day in and day out, sleeping in the same tent, walking side by side, do you get to the point where you need your own space?
Oh, well, we actually didn't walk side by side that often. We usually we'd be sort of within sight of each other, but we didn't walk next to each other and talk to each other the whole time. I mean, I don't think really at all, did we, Glenn?
No, I mean, you're right.
We'd talk to each other. We'd take breaks together, but when we were actually hiking, we were just sort of each in our own world.
I think that's maybe overstating it a little bit. I mean, we didn't try to avoid each other, but, you know, at times we had our different paces. At times we're next, you know, one in front of each other, you know, hiking and, you know, breaks, lunch and all that, of course, you know, but other times, you know, we're separated a little bit. I mean, always, you know, not too far off, but, I mean, the short answer to your question is, no, I think we got along pretty well.
Yeah, we definitely.
Hey, I wasn't trying to back you guys into a corner, but, and kind of a follow-up to the question, though, right? Like, you know, there are people that go out there solo. And I'm sure you ran into plenty of people that were out there solo. you know, the guys that are out there, the girls that are out there alone, are they really alone, or are they constantly running into other people and, you know, essentially it's a, sort of the social crowd that you get on the AT, or is it very different than the Appalachian Trail? And, you know, if you're by yourself, you're truly by yourself. How do you comment on that?
Well, there were, I mean, we kind of, you know, would leapfrog a couple other there was one solo guy, actually a couple solo guys that we saw, you know, for several days in a row. We'd pass him, then he'd pass us. And but it's not, I don't think it's quite like the AT in that when you camp at night, most nights we were the only ones in our spot because, you know, you just sort of find a spot and camp. So there aren't really people concentrated each night in one place. But, you know, we would pass people and, you know, stop and chat with them. But for the most part, it was, you know, you just sort of see them, say hi, talk for a few minutes, but we didn't, you know, camp with them at night or anything.
Yeah, I mean, I do recall, like, at Vermilion Valley Ranch or Red's Meadow, you know, if there were big campgrounds, I think people were very sociable there, you know, and chatty. And going that time of year when it's the best time to go, you're not out there by yourself. You're always passing people. So, to Susan's point, it's not the social atmosphere of the AT, but you're not alone, and people are friendly, and, you know, stop to chat when you pass them.
And to your point, I've been to the Vermilion Valley Ranch. We actually did a hike up to Mott Lake, you know, with the John Muir Trail being part of that hike. But, yeah, very social scene there. It was a lot of fun. You know, a lot of the through hikers came in, and we enjoyed sitting around the campfire with them. But, hey, so on that topic, I got to ask you guys, I mean, there's a lot of stops on the trail. You've mentioned a few. What were some sites that you, or at least stops on the trail, or even on, you know, off the trail, that you remember that are vivid in your mind that made the whole experience pretty valuable to you?
Well, I'd say that's a tough question because, I mean, the scenery on this trail is just, I mean, every turn you're making, you have a different view. I mean, really, there are a few spots on this trail where there's really nothing to look at or where, you know, you don't have outstanding views. I mean, just the views are just amazing throughout. So I really couldn't pinpoint one. I know, Susan, you had probably a thought or two as far as where we camped or, you know, maybe a favorite there, didn't you?
Yeah, there were a few, but it was mostly sort of the experience was like, you know, each day you'd say, oh my gosh, this is amazing, this is even better than yesterday, and then the next day it would surpass that day, and it's just, I mean, the views that you get are amazing, and just the space and the altitude and just the emptiness of it, you know, because you're looking out over this vast wilderness and, you know, you're not seeing any buildings or anything like that, any roads, and it just gets better and better while you're out there. But as far as sort of places I really liked, Marie Lake was really nice. Evolution Valley is just gorgeous, you know, like the whole time you're walking. You know, it's kind of like on some trails, you hike for a while trying to find a good lunch spot, and here it's just you want to keep stopping for lunch because, you know, you every time you turn around, there's another beautiful spot that you would love to just sort of sit and hang out in for a while.
So you guys have, you know, done a lot of miles on the long trail. How do you compare the scenery on the John Muir to the long trail? I mean, I got to believe that there's a lot more open space, but I'll let you guys speak to that.
Yeah, it doesn't really compare. I mean, yeah, the long trail, love the long trail, and we've really enjoyed hiking on that. But I mean, the John Muir Trail, you're just, I mean, literally these amazing vistas constantly, and you're going over these huge, you know, these tall passes, and you can just see for miles and miles and miles, and it's just, I don't know, it's hard to describe just sort of that feeling of openness, and we've done a lot of backpacking at this point, and nothing has really compared to that. I mean, Glacier is close because Glacier is just phenomenally beautiful, But, you know, this, it was just every single day, every moment of every day, you just had wonderful views the whole time.
So let's talk about Mount Whitney, because the trail does end there, and, you know, obviously an amazing summit that you can see, I'm sure, in every direction, although I haven't been there myself. But talk a little bit about Whitney, the climb. What are the views like from the top? Talk about the crowds and the trail itself trying to get up there. Can you give us some insight into that experience?
Well, pretty much everybody who's coming to Whitney from the John Muir Trail, they camp at Guitar Lake the night before, and then hike up from there. And it really wasn't that bad of a hike, I didn't think, getting up to the summit. But there are some people who, I don't know what time they were getting up, but they got up very early because they wanted to see the sunrise from the summit. We were not that ambitious, so we didn't do that. But I mean, once you get up to that last little bit of the summit, there's a crowd up there. There are a lot of people, and again, we were there when the weather was just so perfect, and, you know, so there were tons of people coming up from Whitney Portal. So, you know, the right before you get to Guitar Lake is kind of when you say goodbye to the solitude.
So as you climb Whitney, is it hand-over-hand climbing, or for the most part you are, you know, just following a pretty well-worn trail without, you know, any particularly difficult
terrain?
Yeah,
it's a well-worn trail. From Guitar Lake really to Whitney, I mean, you're doing switchbacks, and then you got a well-worn trail with lots of people on it. So you're, you know, as Susan said, you know, no solitude. You've got, and you'll pass people who, if they've just come up in the past day or two, you know, kind of altitude sickness, you know, kind of needing to take a break and all of that. What sticks in my mind is there's a big logbook when you get to the top of Whitney that you could sign. I don't want to say we waited in line, but there were a couple people in front of us. The guy in front of us, he's signing the logbook, and obviously he's not feeling too well. He just kind of steps to the side, throws up, and then goes back to finishing signing his book. So obviously, you know, altitude sickness had gotten to him as well. But certainly big crowds. I don't want to say big crowds, but a lot of people up there. It's no problem finding someone to take your picture, you know, hand your camera to them and get your photo. But, you know, it's fun. It's a good atmosphere and, you know, just fantastic views that you can't even describe up there.
I'll give it to the guy. That's dedication. You want your name in the book pretty badly in that situation. So, I mean, what a difference for you guys going from, you know, probably having some solitude out on the JMT before you got to Whitney. Talk about that for a minute. Were you guys alone a lot of the time on the JMT, or were you constantly running into people and you didn't really feel that, you know, that you were that isolated from society?
I don't think we were ever, you know, felt really alone, because you, as I say, you would always see people, you know, either passing people or, you know, maybe people, you know, hiking sections, you know, and going in a different direction. So it's very, very popular. But, you know, as far as camping, you could camp really if you found a, you know, there wasn't really any, for the most part, any set camping. You might find some sites that had been used, but it's nothing that you would reserve or you know, line up in advance. You would just start your day, and when you were ready to stop, you'd say, oh, here's a good stop, you know. So I think in some of the camping, you know, at the end of the day, I mean, you were certainly, you know, had some solitude and, you know, were by yourself. And some of the hiking, you know, you were by yourself as well, but, you know, there were plenty of people around as well.
Yeah, it was kind of a nice mix because, you know, it's nice to see a few people every once in a while just because you think, well, you know, if something happened, it would be nice to have people around. So, I mean, you know, I don't mind seeing people out on the trail. I don't want to see them all the time and camp with them every night. But, you know, it's kind of nice because everybody out there is totally friendly and, you know, and sometimes if they're just out for, you know, a day or two, they might share some of their food, which I got some crackers with Cheese Whiz from some people one day, so that was a bonus.
And we had met some people. Susan, was that the first time we saw those folks that we had met on a previous trip or previous year, or maybe we met people on the John Muir Trail, and then the next year on a different hike we
We ran into them in Glacier in the backcountry.
Yeah, so there were people hiking on John Muir. We met them and struck up a conversation, and then and our next year when we went to Glacier, just random happenstance, we bumped into these people and they were out hiking in Glacier. So it's kind of weird that way.
That's a pretty small world. And Susan, I'm excited to hear that you pulled a Yogi. I didn't know you had it in you. Trying to mooch some food. Hey, so do you guys, if you, just for the folks listening, do you have any recommendations about the John Muir Trail, how you would advise them, things that you would do differently, things that you thought you did right?
I think that our schedule worked out pretty well. I don't know that I'd change really anything major. I don't know, Glenn, do you have any?
No, I thought you had planned it very well. I think I feel like we did a lot of mileage per day, and maybe not everyone would be up for that. We would start, I think, 7 a.m. most mornings we were hiking. We'd hike till a good 4 or 5 o'clock. It was some long mileage. I guess if we had more vacation time or what have you, it'd be nice to maybe not feel as pushed about. I mean, when you got to camp at the end of the day, I mean, even if it was 5 o'clock, it was the end of the day. You couldn't, obviously, high elevations, you can't, it's illegal to do camp fires, but really that's the last thing on your mind. You want to, make some dinner, get your camp set up, and I don't know what time, 7, 8 o'clock, you're in bed because you're tired. So it wasn't really practical for us. It would have been nice to maybe, have a little more flexibility with some shorter mileage. But short of that, I don't think there's any major changes I would make.
Yeah, I would maybe have taken a slightly warmer sleeping bag because I guess I'm a cold sleeper, and I think the bag I took was like a 35-degree bag or something, and I was cold a lot of nights. Not freezing, but just, I'd wake up and be a little bit cold, so.
What did the bag weigh in at for 35 pounds, do you know? Or, excuse me, at 35 degrees? 2-pound, 3-pound bag?
It was a pretty lightweight one. It was synthetic. It wasn't down. That might have been part of the problem. But it was a pretty lightweight bag, and I probably should have. I wouldn't have minded carrying a few more ounces for a bit more warmth. Because, I ended up sleeping in like all my clothes and like I brought a down jacket that I thought I was going to use as a pillow, but I used it as a jacket when I slept, so I didn't really have a pillow.
Glenn, you're neglecting your duties there as a husband. Shame on you. Back in the day, you guys had a big warm husky to probably keep you warm, so maybe Glenn was just out of practice.
No comeback for that one. Yeah, I let her down.
Well, when you've been out there a week or week and a half, you're really not doing a lot of snuggling with that other person because, you get a little dirty on the trail.
Yeah, I can imagine that. That's for sure. So what other trails do you guys have on your wish list? I mean, you've hit a lot of the big ones. I know you spent, like I said, a lot of time on the Long Trail. I know you've done some pieces of the AT. I know you've been to Denali. I know you've been to Glacier. I know you're going to Utah this summer. You guys are definitely outdoor people. What's next? That's the big question.
I don't know. Well, whenever Backpacker Magazine comes and I look in there, I start tearing pages out because I'm we got to do this one and this one and that one. We need to finish the Long Trail because we've got about 100 miles left to go on there.
Tahoe
Rim Trail.
Yeah, I mean, the most immediate thing, I mean, we have the small baby now, so I don't think there's any chance of Susan wanting to get on the trail for a week or two, leaving the baby at home. So, plans and itineraries will definitely be changing. But, most immediate answer to that is next month we're heading out to Utah and doing checking out the national parks and doing a driving loop and a lot of car camping and bringing the baby with us. So this will be her first camping experience out there. So we're really looking forward to that. So as I say, a lot of car camping, maybe some short day hikes, and then we'll just have to see how things go. If it's a success, we could build from there as we plan for next year and moving forward. But yeah, I mean, as far as the long distance trails, there are just so many choices that look appealing, and I just don't know that we'd be getting out for anything really long distance anytime too soon.
Well, I admire your tenacity there to take a not even a toddler on a Western trip, being from the East Coast. So good for you guys. But thanks for the interview today. I'm sure there's a lot of people that are thinking about doing the John Muir that are going to benefit from your knowledge. And it's always a pleasure to catch up with you guys. And maybe we'll be able to log some long trail miles here sometime in the future. So appreciate your time.
Sounds great. Thanks for having us.
All right. Take care, guys. We'll catch you another time.
All righty.
See you.
Thanks for listening to the N2 Backpacking Podcast. This is Bird Shooter, wishing you the best for your travels on the trail. To subscribe to this podcast, visit Apple's iTunes Store or download them directly at n2backpacking.com, the My Podcast tab. Music for this podcast was provided by the John Zed Band. For more information on this Atlanta-based musician, visit his website at johnzed.com. That's johnzed.com. Or search for his latest release through iTunes. This podcast is a production of N2 Backpacking and is copyrighted by N2 Ventures, Inc. For more information or to provide feedback or comments on this or future shows, please visit us at n2backpacking.com. That's little n, number 2, backpacking.com.